You know, there is this very comforting fiction that we tell students in introductory economics.
Oh, I know this one.
It's the idea of the closed economy, this nice, tidy little island where everything that's made is consumed locally.
No one ever looks across the border. The math is simple.
It's a beautiful place to visit on paper, but you definitely would not want to live there.
It simplifies things, sure, for teaching, but it completely ignores the reality that we are living in a world of these messy, chaotic spillovers. If the Fed raises rates in Washington, emerging markets in Asia stumble. If China has a manufacturing boom, prices in Europe shift. No country is an island. Not anymore.
And that's really the theme of today's deep dive. We are shattering that island illusion. We're unpacking Chapter 23 of International Macroeconomics by Corsetti, Dodola, and Lloyd. And I love this source because it doesn't just give you the dry theory. It really grapples with why the theory so often fails to match the real world.
This text is essentially the bridge. It takes us from that isolated, closed economy mindset and just drops us into the deep end of a financially integrated world. The mission here is to understand transmission, how a shock, like a tech boom in Silicon Valley or a recession in the Eurozone, travels through the plumbing of the global economy to affect everyone else.
And to understand that plumbing, we have to look at the scorecard first.
You have to.
We need to talk about the balance of payments, some frankly bizarre puzzles where the real world just refuses to obey the rules, and then finally the models that try to explain why.
We should probably start with that scorecard, because if you can't track the money and the goods, you can't understand the story.
So let's look at the basic accounting. In a closed economy, GDP is simple. It's consumption plus investment plus government spending.
C plus I plus G.
But once we open the borders, we have to add that final variable, net exports or NX.
And that little NX variable, it just changes everything. It's simply the difference between what a country sells to the world and what it buys from it. But you should think of it more like a mirror.
A mirror.
Yeah, because if you're running a trade deficit, importing more than you export, that mirror reflects something really crucial about your financial health. It means you're borrowing.
Which brings us to the balance of payments. I always picture this as a giant set of scales.
That's a good way to see it.
You've got the current account on one side, which is basically trade cars, avocados, consulting services.
And on the other side, you have the financial flows, the financial account. That records changes in who owns what assets.
So if an American buys a factory in Vietnam,
Or a Japanese pension fund buys U.S. Treasury bonds. That lives there. There's also a tiny third bucket, the capital account, for things like patents. But in the grand scheme of things, it's usually pretty negligible.
and the golden rule, the thing that keeps the universe in balance, is that these buckets have to sum to zero.
They absolutely must balance. CA plus FA plus KA equals zero. It's arithmetic. And this is where the insight lies. If the U.S. runs a massive current account deficit,
Buying way more stuff than it sells.
it must run a financial account surplus.
Meaning money has to flow in.
Right. We pay for those extra imports by selling our assets.
Yeah.
We're essentially issuing IOUs to the rest of the world.
The source points to US data from the mid-90s on that shows exactly this: a massive widening of the deficit. We're consuming and investing more than we're saving, and the rest of the world is lending us the money to do it.
Yeah, economists call this era the rise of global imbalances. And it ties into this concept of America's exorbitant privilege.
Because we print the dollar.
Exactly. Because the U.S. issues the world's reserve currency, it's been able to borrow cheaply and sustain these deficits for way longer than, say, Argentina or Turkey ever could.
If another country tried this, the markets would punish them.
Severely. It's like having a credit card with an infinite limit and near zero interest because the bank just trusts you implicitly.
Okay, so that's the accounting. But this is where it gets tricky, right? Because when economists try to build models to predict why capital flows the way it does, the data just stops making sense.
This is the reality versus theory part of the chapter. We call them the puzzles. But before we get to where the models break, we have to look at what the source calls the stylized facts. What actually happens in the wild?
Okay, what are they?
Well, the source lists four big ones. First, trade is pro-cyclical. When the economy grows, trade grows.
That feels intuitive. We have more money, we buy more stuff.
The second fact is a bit more nuanced. Trade balances are counter-cyclical.
Meaning, when a country is booming, its trade deficit gets worse.
Yes. If you think about it, when an economy is hot, consumers and businesses are spending aggressively. They buy up all the local goods, but they also just suck in imports from everywhere else.
And exports don't grow that fast.
Not usually. So the trade balance dips into the red.
Okay, that tracks. What's fact three?
That emerging markets are way more volatile than rich countries. And four, business cycles are synchronized. The G10 economies tend to, you know, rise and fall together.
Which brings us to the failures, the puzzles. Where do the models fall apart?
Well, they fail spectacularly when we look at capital flows. The first stumbling block is the Feldstein-Horioka puzzle.
That sounds like a chess opening.
It kind of does. But standard theory says if capital can move freely across borders, it should just chase the highest returns. It shouldn't care about nationality.
Right. A dollar saved in Japan shouldn't care if it's invested in Japan or Brazil.
Exactly. So in a frictionless world, savings and investment in a single country, they shouldn't really be related.
But the data shows they're highly correlated. If a country saves more, it invests more at home.
Money tends to stay home. And this connects to the next two puzzles. Home bias.
We see it in equities. People mostly buy stocks from their own country.
Even when they should diversify.
Yeah.
And we see it in trade. We buy local goods way, way more than the math suggests we should.
We're parochial. We like our own stuff. But those seem like, I don't know, behavioral quirks. The source mentions a big boss puzzle that completely breaks the standard models.
The Backus-Smith puzzle.
That's the one.
This is the big one. It's all about the relationship between how much we consume and the value of our currency.
Okay, walk me through the theory first. What should happen?
The standard theory assumes what we call complete markets. Basically, you can insure against any risk perfectly. In that world, if a country is consuming more than its neighbors, it means times are good.
Demand is high.
So that country's currency should be strong. We call that real appreciation.
High consumption equals a strong currency. That feels logical. If everyone is in New York spending money, demand for dollars goes up.
But the data shows the exact opposite.
Really?
High relative consumption is correlated with a weaker currency, a real depreciation.
Wait, so if we're on a spending spree, our currency is actually losing value.
The correlation is negative. And for the longest time, standard models just. They could not explain why. It implies that standard risk sharing, where countries pool their luck, it just isn't happening.
Before we solve that mystery, we probably need to clarify what we mean by currency value, because the price of lunch in New York is not the same as the price of lunch in Bangkok.
That distinction is absolutely crucial. You have the nominal exchange rate, that's the ticker you see on the screen, and then you have the real exchange rate.
Which compares the cost of a basket of goods.
Right. This is the whole law one price idea. A MacBook should cost the same everywhere, theoretically.
That's purchasing power parity, or PPP.
Yes, but the source makes it really clear. PPP fails. It fails miserably in the short run. Real exchange rates are incredibly volatile. They jump around way more than fundamentals like inflation or output.
This is the exchange rate disconnect, right? The financial markets are just swinging wildly, but the real economy of factories and supermarkets moves slowly.
It's so disconnected that we have the Mies and Rogoff puzzle. Back in the early 80s, they showed that these complex economic models are worse at predicting exchange rates than a random walk.
A random walk is basically a coin flip.
It's basically just guessing that tomorrow's exchange rate will be the same as today's. And that dumb guess consistently beats the sophisticated models.
Wow.
It's a really humbling realization for economists. Yeah. It tells us there's something else going on in the currency markets. Speculation, noise, something that has nothing to do with the price of milk or cars.
So to recap the mess we're in, we've got home bias, where money refuses to travel. We've got the Backus-Smith puzzle, where consumption and currency move backwards. And we have exchange rates that defy prediction. How does Chapter 23 propose we fix this?
We enter the modeling lab. The authors walk us through a simulation. Imagine a productivity shock. Let's say the U.S. invents some new AI tech that makes it much better at making goods.
Okay, so the U.S. is booming. We're churning out widgets faster than anyone else. What happens next?
Well, they test this scenario in three different financial worlds to see which one actually matches the data.
What's the first one?
World number one is complete markets. This is utopia. Perfect insurance, perfect risk sharing.
So in this world, if the U.S. gets rich, everyone gets rich.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
The U.S. shares the wealth. And because the U.S. is making so much stuff, U.S. goods become cheap, foreigners buy them, and everyone consumes more. But this model predicts the U.S. currency should strengthen.
Which we know is wrong, Backus-Smith. So utopia is out.
Strike one. World number two is financial autarky, the hermit kingdom.
No borrowing, no lending.
None. You can trade goods, but every dollar of imports has to be paid for with a dollar of exports. Immediately. No running a tab. This makes prices swing like crazy to balance trade instantly. It creates way too much volatility.
So that's out too, which leaves us with the third option.
The bond economy. This is the Goldilocks model. It assumes markets are incomplete. You can trade and you can borrow, but you can only trade a single, simple, riskless bond. You can't insure against every possible bad outcome.
This sounds more like real life. I can use a credit card, but I can't buy, you know, loss of job insurance that pays out my exact salary.
Yeah, precisely. And in this bond economy, we finally solve the Backus Smith puzzle.
Yeah.
It comes down to a battle between two forces, the substitution effect and the wealth effect.
Okay, break those down.
The substitution effect is simple. The U.S. gets productive, so U.S. goods are cheaper. People swap expensive foreign goods for cheap U.S. goods. But the wealth effect, that's the killer. And this is where home bias comes back in.
How does that work?
Okay, so imagine the U.S. floods the market with these new goods. But because of home bias, people prefer their local stuff. And because demand is slow to change, the price of U.S. goods crashes. It crashes so hard that even though U.S. producers are selling more units, the value of what they earn drops relative to imports.
Let me see if I get this. It's like a farmer who has a bumper crop of corn. He's got twice as much corn as last year. But to sell it all, he has to cut the price by 70%. So even though his barn is full, his purchasing power, his ability to buy a tractor or imported fertilizer, it's actually gone down.
That is a perfect way to put it. His terms of trade have deteriorated. So even though he's producing more, he feels poorer. And because he feels that wealth hit, he curbs his consumption.
And crucially, his currency, the corn, has depreciated.
So you get a situation where the economy is productive with high output, but the currency is weak and consumption is relatively low.
And that matches the Backus Smith data perfectly.
It does.
The negative correlation. The currency drops and consumption doesn't skyrocket because we feel poorer.
That's the aha moment. It's the frictions, the fact that we prefer local goods and can't perfectly insure ourselves, that make the model match reality. The imperfections are the most important part of the system.
There's one last piece of the puzzle the source brings up, the news shock. This ties back to the trade deficits we talked about.
Yes. This is fascinating. In the bond economy, what happens if the U.S. doesn't get a productivity boom today, but gets credible news that there will be a boom tomorrow?
Like finding out a massive oil field has been discovered or a revolutionary tech is a year away from launch?
You feel richer immediately. You know the money's coming, so what do?
I start spending now. I buy the new car today, knowing I can pay for it when the boom hits.
You borrow from abroad to consume today, and that creates a trade deficit. The bond economy model captures this perfectly. It explains why a country expecting good times ahead will run a deficit. It creates that counter-cyclical current account we see in the data.
Wow. This completely reframes how we look at trade deficits. We always hear about them in the news as a sign of failure.
Living beyond our means.
Losing to our competitors. But through the lens of this model, a deficit can be a sign of extreme optimism.
It's a country betting on its own future productivity. If capital is flowing into the U.S. to fund a deficit, it's because the world believes the U.S. will be wealthy enough to pay it back.
So the U.S. running a deficit might not be a sign of weakness at all. It might be a rational bet that the American engine is going to keep growing.
It's a provocative thought, isn't it? Is the deficit a disaster or is it a down payment on a boom?
That is definitely something to think about next time you see a scary headline about the trade gap. We've gone from closed islands to global credit cards, and somehow it all hangs together by a thread of imperfect markets.
It's a messy world, but the models are finally, slowly catching up to it.
Thanks for guiding us through the chaos.
My pleasure.
And to our listener, thanks for diving deep with us. We'll catch you on the next one.